Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. We're here today to do an interview with John Cleland Host, who is an early founder of Naturalistic Pagan Paths, and to hear what he has to say about the non-theist pagan movement and where we're going and what the challenges are and what his hope is for the future. So I'm really looking forward to talking with John today. My name is Mark, and I'm one of your hosts.
And I'm Yucca. And John, I'm really excited to meet you. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the welcome. I'm John Cleland Host. I'm really glad to be here. It's an honor to be on this incredible podcast that is right along the lines of what I've been hoping for many, many years. And it's great to be here. I'm looking forward to what we can discuss.
Well, great. Well, welcome. I guess the first thing is we were going to ask, would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about who you are, because I'm sure some of our listeners have heard of you before and you may be new for others.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. My name is John Cleland Host. I come from a Detroit auto worker family. We've had auto workers here in Fords, and everyone called it Fords. It wasn't Ford Motor Company. All the way back into almost a century. I was involved with the semiconductor industry for a good 20 years. Maybe I should step back a little bit before that. I grew up here in the Detroit area, went to Michigan Tech. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that. It's not what you would expect from a Michigan university. It is a 12-hour drive away from the Detroit area and is west, actually, if you look on the map, of Chicago. It's so far north that in the wintertime, close to the winter solstice, the sun kind of late in the morning will slowly roll over the horizon and by afternoon dip back down. It's just like night all the time. So yeah, very, very different experience. From there, I went far, far south to the tropics by comparison to Chicago for my graduate degree in material science. I got a degree in PhD in material science and specifically in nanotechnology, and went from there to a research job in the semiconductor industry. I managed a material science lab for 20 years, and that was great, wonderful job. As a lot of industries go, after a little bit of corporate shakeup, they wanted to get rid of the research function, so the PhDs pretty much were laid off. And so, so I went back to my roots, really, in the auto industry, working on research on an auto supplier here, which is really cool because let me tell you, iron has a lot more interesting phase transitions compared to silicon, which doesn't do anything. But with iron, you've got ferrite and martensite and a bunch of other phase transitions that you can do. So that's been a lot of fun. And during that whole time, I worked with my wife, Heather, and I to develop a real science and reality-based spirituality that brought to life the wonder and awe that we see in our universe, both for our kids and for anybody else. We've got a book, Elemental Birthdays, that describes the practice that we have in our family that we've done for a number of decades for celebrating birthdays by atomic number. And it amazes me how obvious and fun this is, and that people haven't been doing it for 50 years, but that apparently is not the case. So in that practice, sixth birthday is a carbon birthday, and eighth birthday is your oxygen birthday. And I just had my tin birthday, so that was a lot of fun. I actually dressed up as the Tin Man, and so that was fun. That was for Samhain. We went out with the kids, which here in Michigan, you know, the weather is always different, and if you don't like it, you can always wait an hour and it'll change. And so we had a mixture of snow and rain with a lot of wind that night, and my Tin Man costume wasn't looking very good by the time I got back in. But I have to say, it was really exciting because my kids were like, "All right, this is wonderful. Let's go to the next house." I'm like, "We are crusted in ice." They're like, "All right, there we go. More candy."
How old are your kids right now?
My kids are 8, 12, 15, 16, and 18. And it's funny when you ask that. I don't know if this is a stereotypical dad type thing, but I think, hold on a second. And then, right. And then I think, oh no, I can just remember what element we celebrated at their last birthday, and that makes it easy. So, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. I've never heard of that before. So I love that idea.
Cool.
I'm going to have a helium and a beryllium in a month. So. Maybe
cool.
We'll start that tradition. Yeah.
The beryllium, the helium's fun because you got, of course, helium balloons. Beryllium is fun because that is one of the main components in emeralds. So we have lots of emeralds around for the birthdays, do a whole pirate theme, and the kids just love it.
Oh, that's great. I was thinking of trying to build a table with them. So I'm really excited about this idea because we could add one each year and make it really, really special that way.
Yeah, that would work really well. Yeah. And when you do the, I've seen a joke with that. You know, you do the regular table, and then on top of that, at the side, you've got the lanthanides and actinides that are kind of like a separate strip, right? So if you did this like as a picnic table, you do that as a bench. Right. And so then you have to warn people, well, that bench might be a little bit unstable.
Yep. That's fantastic. Well,
John, it's delightful to have you here. And your impulse to make accessible and to integrate scientific reality into the ritual practices of your family and your life is so consistent with what we talk about here on this podcast. It's just fantastic. I know that you were doing naturalistic paganism, non-theistic paganism, you know, before I created my own path of atheopaganism. How did you come to non-theist paganism?
Yeah, it was, I don't know. I always wonder when I look at this, how much of this is, wow, that's an interesting path versus, oh yeah, I've heard this story 1500 times, right? And it's always the same. My own path. Oh, but before I get into that, I wanted to say to everybody, happy solstice. We just had our wonderful summer solstice, and out of all the incredible summer solstices we've had, this is one of the very few where we had a solar eclipse on the summer solstice. So that was really cool. The next one isn't until 2039. A lot of us naturalistic pagans are familiar with the fact that the moon tends to follow about a 19-year repeating cycle. So anything that happens a certain year is likely to happen 19 years later. So the next summer solstice solar eclipse is 2039. But of course, just like anything else in the real world, it's not perfect. And because of that, that cycle drifts a little bit. And so that means that you have a span of about maybe 50 or 60 years, depending on the, more than that, maybe 100 years, when the eclipse, when an eclipse can fall on the summer solstice, and then it goes through 100 years or so when it can't. So we actually have eclipses on the solstices, both winter and summer, until about, I'll have to check, but something like 2070, 2080. And then it's going to be another 200 years before they happen again, and then they'll happen again over and over. So really, really a wonderful thing to have an eclipse on a solstice. I wanted to say happy solstice to everyone. It's still the summer solstice day, if you count it as people in Europe, because of course ours was sort of yesterday, depending on how those dates falls. So yes, thank you. Sorry for the diversion. I will get onto my own path. My own path really starts off like an awful lot of us. I mean, literally tens of millions of us starting off being raised as a very dutiful, standard Catholic. I was raised in a Catholic household, very devout, and I was an altar boy, did all the sacraments, confirmation, all that kind of stuff. And as I got into college, I started to think about all these Catholic things, and I realized that I had some doubts, some concerns. And I think this is really actually a little bit uncommon. I think a lot of times more of it is that the first little cracks in the wall come about for a lot of people on emotional things, like, oh, the Catholics or the Christians are being awfully mean to LGBT people, like my friend here, right? Mm-hmm. I have to admit that, I don't know, maybe I can be too cold or something like that, but that wasn't it. What first hit for me was just logical, standard reason type issues. I thought, okay. If I was born in Iran, I would have been a Muslim. Of course, everyone's a Muslim. You're raised being a Muslim. And if that's the case, according to standard Catholic doctrine, I would be tortured forever in writhing pain in hell. Well, what kind of justice is that based on where I was born? And just a bunch of very simple logical things like that. And logically, I thought, oh, I'm being silly. I'm being silly because these are obvious questions that anyone's going to come up with. And there have been an awful lot of very intelligent Catholic, you know, scholars over the years, St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine and all this kind of stuff that I've been taught about. I thought, oh yeah, they must have thought about this. This must be the first thing that's covered in seminary where they say, okay, you're coming into seminary. We're going to have answers to simple questions 101, where we cover these things. And then you're like, oh, that's obvious. What was I thinking? And then that's the end of it, right? So I thought, oh yeah, they know these questions. So I went, so on the holiday break in December, on my first year, coming back from college, I thought, I'm just being silly. In fact, these are so stupid, so obviously, embarrassingly straightforward that I'm not even gonna go to the church that I'm used to, where I know everyone and the priest and everybody, because they're gonna say, come on, you're an altar boy, you should know better than this. No, I'm gonna go to the next town over and go to the Catholic priest there and ask him these questions, and he'll tell me, and then I'll be all set. So I went to the next town over and booked an appointment. You know how that goes. And so he comes in and I sit down and he says, okay, you know, what's the thought here? And I said, well, da 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 da. And I told him what I just told you, or another one. I don't remember which one. It's like, you know, if you think about like the Odyssey or 100 other questions, there's like 100 that are really obvious. And so he kind of knowingly nodded his head and said, I can understand that you would think that and wonder about that. What's your next question? And I was like, oh, well, that one was so obvious, he didn't even bother to answer it. It must be really obvious. So I went to the next one. I described that. And after this same thing happened about four or five times, and we're almost done with our time slot, he said, yeah, those make a lot of sense. So, you know, here's a book that covers some of these. And he handed me this book. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've got the answers in the book right here in my hand. So I left and I ran out to the car and I sat down and I tried to start reading the book. Well, this is Michigan and it's late December. It's freezing cold. So I couldn't do that for very long. I got to a couple pages. I didn't exactly find what I wanted. I was like, all right, fine. I'm just going to go home. So I went home, got the book out, read the whole thing cover to cover. And it had stuff like, this is how we know the Protestants are wrong when they say that Jesus had brothers and Mary, and so Mary wasn't ever virgin. And it talked about how we could understand this Greek word as meaning cousins instead of brothers. I'm like, no, that's not what I was looking for at all. These were very basic questions. And that's when it hit me. Hold on. Maybe they don't have answers to these. And after that, as I started to look into this, I realized that was the case. They really didn't have answers to these because the question showed that the whole system didn't make sense. And from there, I just went to, you can imagine, you know how this went, right? This went to straight atheism, right? I went to a straight atheist path and thought, okay, this is just ridiculous. And as I lived like that for a number of years, that was really quite good and a wonderful improvement. But even with that, there was not the fullness of life. You know what they say, you can take the boy out of Catholicism, but you can't take the Catholicism out of the boy, right? I thought, I really like that incense. It smells really nice. Those candles are really cool, even if they're just candles. And I thought, all right. I need a little bit more human connection, a little more symbolism and metaphor in my life. And I thought, you know what, just really basic, completely unassailable, reasonable thing. I realized that our ancestors, all of our ancestors, for literally tens of thousands, maybe hundreds, I'm not sure, have really been touched, moved, felt incredible dread and in joy at the winter solstice sunrise. I thought, I'm just going to connect to that. Just like so many of us over so many years as human beings across so many cultures in every single continent on Earth, except for Antarctica, have done this. And so I started just simply going and watching the sunrise on the winter solstice. This was actually quite easy because at the time I was in graduate school, material science graduate school at Northwestern University, which is on the shore of Lake Michigan in Chicago, which of course is the western shore facing east. It's easy to see the sunrise across Lake Michigan. So I started doing this. And after a number of years, I thought, every time, even if it was cloudy, which was a lot of the time, I would come back feeling so enmeshed, so empowered, so connected to our human family and our universe that I thought, this is wonderful. I need to do this. In fact, one year, I think it was 1996, not hard to check, as I was in the car driving, you know, with this sunrise, I heard on the radio that on that winter solstice, Carl Sagan had died. And I thought, yes, this truly is the darkest day. As that continued, I realized over time that, hold on a second, this isn't the only solstice. There's another one. So I started paying attention to the summer solstice, and my birthday is very close to an equinox. So I was already celebrating that. And then pretty soon I added the other solstice, the other equinox rather, and it's some of the cross quarters, which, Arwen, I'm not sure if you saw this. I know Mark and I have talked about it many times, but you know, here in Michigan, at least, and in a lot of places in the West, not California, the daylight, of course, covers a sine wave, right? It has a peak at each solstice, a peak at the bottom, and a halfway point in between. And of course, the temperature does that too, because it takes a little while for everything to warm up and cool down. And in most areas, not in California, it makes an approximate sine wave too. And it makes an approximate sine wave that's behind in phase by about 6 weeks. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's got the same thing. You've got these peaks, you've got these halfway points. Instead of a solstice, you've got a thermistice for the winter thermistice when it's coldest, and a summer thermistice when it's warmest. And of course, the equitherms when it's partway in between. And all of a sudden, you've got these cross-quarter holidays. So I started celebrating some of those. And somewhere along there, I was talking with my wife about these, and we're doing these because we kind of built this together. And I have I been living under a rock or something? All of a sudden, there's like, no, there's thousands of people who celebrate these same holidays. I'm like, what's going on? Well, of course they do, because they're actually real. They're not the commemoration of some mythical event that didn't actually happen, has been built up for social control or whatever, but they actually follow from our sun and moon and earth and the actual seasons we all experience. And so then I thought, all right, well, these are really cool and they're so meaningful and they've touched my life so much. Now I can merge this celebration, this life way, with my understanding that it was from the start that these are completely naturalistic and they're just the changes in the temperature and the light cycle, and there's nothing supernatural about them, and came upon the path of naturalistic paganism. My wife and I talked a lot about what we're going to call it, and that's what we came upon for a number of reasons. And we made a web page in 2003 on it.
Wow, that's delightful.
That's a fantastic story, John. Really extraordinary. So that's how you came to non-theist paganism, and you've participated a lot in various kinds of non-theist paganism stuff since then. You've participated in the Godless Paganism book that John Halsted edited, and in the Atheopaganism Facebook group, and you're on the working group for the development of the Atheopagan Society. What do you see as the issues that are most important for us to confront as a community right now?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it really hinges on the definition of us. I think that there's very important issues for on a number of levels wherever one puts that view of us. So maybe if I think about this from the outside in first, if I take a look at us as far as humans go, right? I look at us as humans, which I think is probably the most important us. It is, of course, a huge number of issues. We've certainly seen more in the last month come to the surface that were always there, in addition to a ton of other ones. But for us as humans, I think the most important thing is going to be people coming together for a common goal. If we have a common idea as to what is real, then it's going to be natural for us to agree on what's important. Let me back up a little bit. Anthropologists have noted for a long time that what a religion is a communication that says what's real and what's important, those two things. And as an extension of what's important, what do we do, right? So the what's real is a worldview, is what do we think is real, whether we're talking about a naturalistic worldview or a Hindu worldview or a Buddhist karmic type worldview or a Abrahamic worldview or something like that. They tell us what's real. And if someone really thinks on a most basic level that what's real is if we don't follow what Yahweh says, he will punish us forever, then that leads to a very different approach to what we should do than if we think maybe you might believe in nirvana versus a karmic cycle or whatever, or a lot of other, there's all kinds of different worldviews, right? If we take a naturalistic worldview, then what's important for us as humans to thrive is to make things better for real humans in this real world, both in this generation and in generations to come. So that's what I think is important for us if we look at a framework of humans. It's understanding and coming to a common agreement as far as how we want to live together and make the world a better place for real people. Now, in America, if I significantly narrow that focus down to the tiny fraction of humans that are Americans, I think that we have a real serious issue with reality denial. And part of that reality denial is because of this whole worldview issue. If people are using an authority, power-based worldview based on the Abrahamic religions, then the proper thing to do is to whip people into submission and enforce that worldview where you've got certain things that are patriarchally right based on the scripture and certain things that are patriarchally wrong based on the scripture. And if anyone disagrees, they get tortured just as they will be by the just God in the afterlife anyway. That's a very different approach than trying to make things as good as possible for all human beings, because human beings have value in and of themselves. Very, very different. So when I look at that, I really think that as an American society, what's most important for us going forward is accepting the reality shown by evidence. And I don't think that's a arbitrary or biased favoring of one worldview over another. Because if we take the worldview of any other worldview where we say we're going to believe such and such because such and such person said so because they had a revelation, then of course one logically has to say, okay, then if that's the case, then of course I have to accept this other person's divine revelation. And if you do that, they of course don't agree because they all contradict each other. One of them says this is the only one path, the other one says this is the only one path. As soon as you do that, you're faced with a bunch of contradictory claims to divine revelation. If you say, okay, I'm going to be completely unbiased, I'm not going to favor any worldview, what I'm going to do is say, okay, to sort these out, how could I possibly sort these out? The only thing you can do is go by evidence that everyone can see. If you go by evidence that everyone can see, then the worldviews and the claims that are supernaturally based cancel each other out and tend to disprove each other and are disproven by other basic facts that we can observe and that we can record and that everyone can agree on, including millions of people studying things from all kinds of different cultural perspectives. So when we do that, we realize that a naturalistic approach is not picking one worldview over the others. It's the exact opposite. It's saying, no, I'm going to not favor any worldview over the others. I'm not going to go by the threat of force or one claim or the other. And I'm going to say, okay, I'm just going to look at the evidence. And when you do that, then we realize that the only thing that floats to the top is a naturalistic worldview that says, okay, we don't know anything for sure. Everything is at least tentative, but we can say that certain conclusions are at least very likely until we get better evidence. And when we do that, then looking at us as an American society, we really have to try to move forward with saying, okay, we're going to actually look at the evidence from science and the evidence that we have and try to make the world a better place for everyone. And that's a serious problem because we've got a good chunk of society, maybe 35 or 40%, that would much rather just use force to impose a supernatural worldview on everybody else.
Sorry to interrupt you, John.
Go ahead, yeah.
It's a privileged 35, 40%. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's something that you've talked about before, that Christian privilege becomes a serious problem in the orbiting of this change, that as long as the thumb is on the scales weighted towards Christianity, it becomes very hard to move towards an evidence-based decision-making process.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the point. Thank you. And it's striking how we have at least begun to talk about privilege for a number of dominant groups, like male privilege, like white privilege. I can say male privilege in a lot of areas and not be immediately condemned and suffer social repercussions. We are not yet there regarding Christian privilege. If I say Christian privilege, right. And it seems like a lot of these oppressive groups go from a stage of not being able to say anything at all, and if you do, you're either punished or ignored, to a stage of not being able to say anything, and if you do, you are punished and not ignored. And then to the stage of, if you say something, some people agree with you, but you're still mostly punished. To a stage of, if you say something, a lot of people agree with you, and then there's a big controversy. To a stage of, oh yeah, everyone accepts that, and now we've moved forward. With male privilege, with white privilege, with straight privilege, and stuff like that, categories where I'm very clearly in the privileged group, right? We're well farther along that path. But in the case of Christian privilege, it's still right in the first stage, or maybe almost to the second. It's exciting to see, because when I was a kid in the 70s, there was certainly no question at all. It was completely in the first category where you couldn't say anything at all. And it's exciting to see that start to change. So yeah, definitely. So then from there, and that's probably the biggest challenge, because that's a very significant group of people. If I move to a much, much smaller group of people and say, okay, now I'm going to look at atheists, right? I think in the atheist community, we've gotten through a lot of that stuff. We're certainly, of course, a lot more able to recognize and talk about Christian privilege. But there's still significant issues with sexism and racism and in other funny little areas where we still have progress to make.
Yes.
You and I know very well that there's a very strange problem with the atheist community that is not present in the wider community of being able to openly talk about the need for rituals, metaphors, symbolism, and other things like that in our lives. So that's an area in atheism. I don't think it's nearly as big a problem as the sexism and sometimes the racism. So there's those. In the parallel community of pagans, it's almost the opposite. You're completely open to talk about, you know, metaphors and magic and all this kind of stuff. But boy, if you at all broach the topic of postmodernism being harmful because all ideas are equally true is obviously wrong, then, you know, you have a problem there. If you talk about challenging the harm done by all the woo stuff, both in the enforcement of patriarchal power structures where people can be exploited. Other people know about that better than I do because, as you saw from my history, I came from the atheist side. Or pointing out the exploitation of the most vulnerable people who might be suffering with cancer or something like that, and you bring out, oh, we just put these cups on your back and you'll be fine from cancer. Give us $10,000.
Yeah.
And yeah. where the most vulnerable people are exploited.
I'll horn in here for a second.
Yeah.
It's worse, which is the victim blaming. You created this for yourself, and therefore you have this cancer because you didn't think right or you didn't live right. I mean, and that is just so poisonous.
Oh, it's absolutely. So
last life. Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right. It was your past life. Or this life, you have too much negativity and you ate food with too much toxins in it and all that stuff. Right. It's horrible. Yep. Yep. Absolutely. So
John, I don't know whether you had finished with this topic or not, but I think this sort of dovetails into the next thing that we were going to talk about, which is, what is your perspective on the non-theist pagan movement? Where do you see us going, and what do you think our challenges are, and what do you think our opportunities are?
Yeah, thank you. I think that I think it dovetails very nicely because I had taken the us, right? What is important mm-hmm. for us down from humans through Americans, through atheists and pagans, down to us naturalistic pagans. And I think that on one hand, and I think the more important point is that I'm really excited. It's incredible how many people are coming to us and how we are growing over the years. I've been involved with Unitarian Universalism for over two decades. I've been involved with different groups and things like that. And so often it seems like the situation is where people are perfectly happy to be helping a movement that might not necessarily be doing a lot of good as long as they're getting their paycheck, and letting things die slowly as long as they can make it to retirement. I find that incredibly demotivating. And I look in contrast to our atheopaganism, naturalistic paganism, all those groups, and I think, wow, look at this. We have real excitement. We have real people coming. We're really growing. We have incredibly talented people in this who really care. And I see so much energy coming in the long-term trends. And it's sometimes, luckily, only briefly, possible for me to look at and say, oh, well, maybe we're not going all that fast. And I think, hold on a second. You're a human being who lives a few decades, and these trends take centuries. And I'm looking at this as like, oh, I'm not sure you've grown enough in the last year. Come on. I mean, from the Protestant Reformation until we had Protestant churches in the United States that were established like that, it was a couple centuries. And by that, we are growing by leaps and bounds at light speed. And I see all that and I think, wow, this is incredible. I see the real good it's doing so many people over and over, both in our wider society and in individual lives. And it's really, really cool, especially someone who now has lots of gray hair and is past 50. I'm like, all right, cool. You know, now we're seeing something that if you had told me this when I was 25 in the middle of the Christian dominant 80s, I would have been like, yeah, right. Like in 2250, maybe. No, this is real and this is really cool. So that's my biggest perspective. On top of that, I see a couple other things. One of them is that we can, some other groups can have a lot of power. They can have a lot of power and a lot of influence and get a lot of things done because they have unbelievable amounts of money. If you've ever looked at the, for instance, the Templeton Prize or something like that. And also huge amounts of political power. We have neither of those and we're still doing really well. And so I look at that and I think, what challenges, serious, deadly challenges will we face in the future as we grow to the point where we start to attract power and money? And when we do that, it's going to be very difficult for us to keep our integrity. I think it's possible, and I think we can do it because we face reality head on instead of making up a bunch of other supernatural stuff about it. But it's certainly not going to be easy. And I think it's likely, for instance, you know, long after I'm dead, that maybe, hopefully, we would get to the point where there's different groups and maybe one or two of them is completely corrupt and hopefully or mostly corrupt or partially corrupt. I don't want to fall into the either or thinking that everyone is either bad or good. We're all somewhat bad and we all have traces of bad stuff in us. And any organization that grows out of this movement is going to be susceptible to that. And it's quite likely that there will be a number of schisms in groups that might be a little more corrupt than the next one or something like that. And I hope that our spiritual ideological descendants, including our actual biological descendants, can try to sort that out in at least a decent way that allows us to move forward for the benefit of everybody. I'm optimistic that that could happen. So those are some long-term things. The short-term things, like I said, I'm very happy about. And I think that our near-term challenge is finding our collective voice. I think we're doing a good job with that. I think we've got some great first steps. I think that it's an ongoing challenge where we can clearly communicate to people what we stand for, why these things are important, how we can make people's lives wonderful and fulfilling, how we can help people feel good and do good. Both, not just one or the other. A lot of times people who do a lot of good don't feel good about it. It's exhausting. Or a lot of times people who feel really good do so because they're exploiting others and don't want to really face it. And that's why they feel good. So to feel good and do good both together is a big challenge. I think we can do it. I think we're moving in the right direction. I'm glad to see it.
That's great. That's great. You know, I have to say that in working to organize the Atheopagan Society, one of the things that's been really important to me is to try to put precepts and structures in place that make it impossible for that kind of corruption that you talk about to happen. you know, saying from the outset, our books are going to be open to the community.
Right.
We're not paying our board members, you know, we have these as straight policies.
Right.
And I think that that's part of what people are, because people are very cynical now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that a part of what will attract people to participate in this is when they see real integrity and real transparency, because otherwise they'll just go, they're in it for a buck. There's a profit to be made in this somewhere down the line, and I'm not going to participate because I'm not a sucker.
Right. Another plastic shaman.
Right.
Right.
Right. And no, that's not what we're about at all. I mean, what we're about is helping people to have happier lives and helping to make the world a better place. Okay. And I have to say, I have one ace in the hole, which is that it happens that Jared Huffman, who is the founder of the House Free Thought Caucus, Congressional Free Thought Caucus, he is both my congressional representative and someone who I know personally because I worked on his campaign.
Wow, that's awesome.
It is. And so, you know, I really feel like we have a little bit of a pipeline into power more than we might have had. If, for example, if the IRS refuses to consider the Ethiopagan Society as a religious nonprofit, I'm going to Jared and I'm going to say, you call the IRS and,
right.
You know, please make our case for us because our spirituality counts just as much as anybody else's does.
Right. That's excellent. Yeah. That's great to hear. And one more thing to move forward. Yeah. I really wish it were something that could be feasibly done to make it impossible for these kinds of human tendencies to get in the way. I'm glad that we're trying to make it impossible. And I think that in doing so, we'll succeed in making it a little bit more difficult.
You know, there are a number of pagan organizations out there that have set themselves up, and some of them have had very lofty morals, and some of them have not. I mean, I know of one particularly that was set up as a tax dodge.
Right. But
I don't think any of them have ever, there's that problem in the pagan community of the sort of charismatic narcissist leader.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And frequently those organizations have been set up by those kinds of people and they're not really quite willing to be accountable.
Right.
Like, yes, I am transparent, but you can't look at my checkbook.
Right.
And I mean, as far as I'm concerned, we need to go overboard on right. being high integrity. We need to be so clean
right.
that our culture is about being clean.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that in that we might have at least one minor advantage that will help us, and hopefully it will help us that we can say, look, we all have brains that evolved through natural selection, and that means that we all have the tendency to try to game the system, and I will never try to say that I'm above reproach because I know I'm not, and I know that I have a brain just like everybody else that came along the same paths and the same things are in it. That's at least one small thing where not being attached to a dualistic worldview helps us. Because when someone thinks, and most people do think, that we are these floating ghosts that are inhabiting a body, that's why someone can be possessed by a demon, right? That this floating ghost can be completely pure and above reproach. And when we say, no, that's not the case, we can't be because we have a standard brain that evolved just like anyone else's, then at least that gives us one smaller step towards humility.
That's really well said, John. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are at just about an hour. Amazingly enough. Quick question, John. Top three things that the non-theist pagan community should work on in one sentence or less.
Okay, top three things. Let's see how this goes. You know, I think the top one is getting rites of passage accessible to people so they can start doing things. By rites of passage, I mean name blessing ceremonies for babies. I mean marriages with written out scripts that people can just download and use, including officiants that they can find for a naturalistic pagan ceremony who can officiate it and find a nice natural place to do it. Funerals are the same way. I've seen a sea change in my very short life when I was a kid in the 70s and 80s. The few funerals that I went to, and it's only a few, but they were, every single one was a sermon about how Christianity is correct and how if you don't get right with Christianity, you will be tortured forever. That's what a funeral was. And in the last 20 years, I've seen that radically change to where very often the person's life is even mentioned. And people talk about things about the person, and it's a celebration more about the person in at least a few of the cases. So things like that. Number one, I would say we need to go in that direction and make ourselves available, because there are literally tens of millions of people desperately looking for that. Second area, I think that we do need to form groups more nationally accessible for people to make this part of their lives. It's really good to be able to connect with people online, because as soon as you have that, you start to find out that you're not completely alone. But the next step after that is to actually do things. And it's great to see things like Moon Meet and other things going on out there. But for the vast majority of us in the United States, I'm in Michigan, those things just simply aren't available. So that would be number two. And I wonder number three might be organization. I hate to say it because I know people have a big problem with that, but it really makes things last longer beyond any of us. I mean, I have to face the reality that in 30 years, I probably will be dead. And in 20 years, I won't be as effective in thinking and talking about things. And so we really need organization to move things beyond the few of us that are able to get things going. So those are my top three. They're probably not the best top three, but hopefully they're at least up there.
Well, I have one more question for you on this. Yeah. So that's what you'd like to see happen. What is one thing that you have seen in, say, the past year or the past 10 years that just delights you in terms of what has happened with non-theist paganism?
Absolutely. I can think of three things right off the bat.
Okay.
First of all the stuff that Mark has been doing, to have the Facebook group with an actual discussion going on all the time, have a blog regularly posted, is all really, really helpful, because there's so many thousands, literally thousands of people who come to this by whatever path, either the way I came from the atheist side or the way Mark came from the pagan side or whatever. Looking for this stuff and saying, oh my gosh, there's actually people talking about this and there's groups I can talk to and do things. So that's been one wonderful thing. Another one, and this is really significant, is we have grown to be more accepted in the pagan community and even in the atheist community. It's far from perfect in either place, I know. But oh my gosh, if we saw the whole naturalistic pagan kerfluffle of, what was it, 2014, end of 2014, beginning of 2015, right? I mean, that wouldn't happen today, I don't think. I don't think we would have as a very strong response from so many sectors of the pagan community saying, no, we completely reject this as paganism. And now I think we'd have a much greater response from so many more segments of the pagan community saying, no, we do accept this. It's been a lot of work. It's been a lot of talking to people. And it's especially amazing to me that we have made all that progress despite and in countercurrent to the increasing polarization that we see in society just as a whole, especially with more of the devotional polytheists, that we could actually make that progress while that was going on. I mean, even if we only stayed in one place, I would see it as a significant step forward, and we've done more than that. So there's a couple things just right off the bat.
Wow. Hmm. Yeah, I agree with that totally. And we have resources.
Yeah.
And John, you've been a part of that. Arwen, you're a part of that. If people go looking for non-theist pagan these days, they will find it. They'll find Facebook groups. They'll find websites. They'll find podcasts. They'll find YouTube channels. There's stuff to help support them in their discovery that a spirituality of reality is something that is real.
On an aside, and you might take this one out, but I'm sitting here, and right back here, right behind me, is my Cosmala. And if we want to do stuff with some of that or other similar practices, I'm up for that. Arwen, you probably don't know what I'm talking about.
It kind of looks like, I've been looking at it in your background. It looks a little bit like a rosary, maybe, that you've got.
It is very much like a rosary. What it is a set of beads, several hundred beads, with beads for events in our actual history. Starting with the Big Bang, I've got one with the formation of the solar system, the formation of mitochondria, the great rain that filled the oceans, all the way up through evolution on Earth, including more recent things like Darwin's Origin of Species and things like that.
Wow. How do you, just a technical question, how do you handle the more time scale on that? When you get
question.
To your more recent.
I can tell you this. It's not a linear scale.
Okay.
Right. You can do it with a linear scale. But what I have is I have...
Wrap around your whole house in that case.
Exactly. Right. And everything that's... And a lot of the things that we are familiar with would be just in the last little segment. Right. No. I have... This is probably more involved than a lot of people can do it. And I don't recommend this. For my Cosmala, what I have is I have spacer beads, little glass beads between each of the events. And those actually count for a set number of years, depending on the color of the spacer beads. So if you look at the spacer beads that I've got between the formation, say, of the first stars and the formation of the solar system, which is actually a second or third generation star, then those beads are, 100 million years each or something like that. Whereas if you go all the way up past Darwin's Origin of Species up to the invention of electronics with the transistor or something like that. I've actually got a little transistor I've built a hole through. I've used it as a bead. Stuff like that. Those beads are worth 2 years each. And of course, during the middle of the Cretaceous, they're worth 2 million years each or something like that. So you can see that I've got a nonlinear scale so that I've got events in logical sequence. What I recommend for most people is to simply put the events in order and have little spacers between them, and it's okay. It's not linear, and that's fine.
Sure.
It's too much math.
It's a milestone.
Unless you love the
scale.
Math.
Right.
Yes.
Unless you love the math.
If you love the math, that's great. Otherwise, it's a milestone tracking,
yes,
and
exactly.
that's the most important thing, right? We're there to acknowledge the milestones. I love your Cosmala. It's so cool.
Thank you.
I remember when you brought it to Pantheacon.
You brought the
shorter one to Pantheacon.
Right. Yeah.
But I remember you had one that was signed by Starhawk and one that was signed by Stephen Hawking, I think.
Almost. I've got a number of them that are signed, and I'm very proud of those. My bead for the beginning of symbolic religions, which is a mother goddess religion bead, is the one that's signed by Starhawk. And I got that signed at Pantheacon. I've got a number of them. I've got one bead that looks like one of these front teeth, and it's for our last common ancestor between us and chimpanzees. And I got that signed by Jane Goodall.
Oh, wow.
That one. My bead for Darwin's Origin of Species is, of course, not signed by Charles Darwin. That would be tough. But it's signed by Richard Dawkins. And so, yeah, I've got a number of them. I'm also very happy with the bead that I have for, the Cretaceous extinction at the end of the Cretaceous, the asteroid. My bead for that's actually a piece of tektite. Aaron, are you familiar with tektite? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of funny. When I was a kid, when I was 15 years old, I found out about tektites, about how, you know, these pieces of rock had been blasted out of the Earth's crust by meteor impacts and solidified up in the atmosphere and then fallen back down after going into space. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's so incredible. I wonder if maybe, I hope as an adult, one day, maybe when I'm 45, I'll be at a museum and I'll be able to see a tektite behind glass. And then maybe 5 years after that, I was in this rock shop and I was walking through and they had a barrel of agates and a barrel of rose quartz, and they had a barrel and it said tektites 50 cents. And I was just, and I thought, oh yeah, we've been hit by a lot more meteors than I thought.
Yes. So
anyway, my piece for the Cretaceous extinction is actually a tektite. And I got it signed by Walter Alvarez, the son, the father-son pair, who figured out what actually killed off the dinosaurs.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's a great idea.
Thank you.
And yeah.
Thank you. It's not mine. I heard that from Michael Dowd, who heard it from two Catholic nuns who were adapting their rosary to reality. So yeah. And I do actually use it for spiritual practices. I often take it on trips just so I feel more connected when I'm out away from everything I'm familiar with. I might sit with it in my stone circle when I do my morning dedication or some other time. And it's amazing. Even with hundreds of beads, you can very quickly, knowing the sequence of when things happen, be able to feel with even your eyes closed what a bead feels like and think, oh yeah, 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 yeah. This is the first tetrapod on land. Oh yeah, I feel this next one. Okay, this is amniotic eggs allowing us to move completely out of the water. Okay, I feel this next one. And to feel that at a visceral level is so moving.
Mm.
Sounds like a great project for you to do with your kids, Arwen.
You know, I've been scribbling notes down furiously here.
Arwen, check out my resources online. I have the timelines online that you can pick from for some of these events. You don't have to come up with them. You can pick from a set of, like, say, 400 events and say, okay, I'm going to pick the top 80 that I like or something like that. Yeah.
So, I will put this in the show notes for everybody, but can you let folks know where to find this information and find more of your work?
I'll do that. I'll make a note to message you guys the links.
Okay. You do have a website that we can direct them to?
Yes.
Let's see here. Okay.
In fact, you know, the funny thing is
naturalpagan.com, right?
Yes.
Com or org?
Org. I think it's org.
Oh, it's org. Okay.
Yeah. So naturalpagan.org.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with naturalpagans.com,
right,
which is a site that it's an aggregation site that pulls together writing from naturalistic pagans all over the place. It includes my writing and John's writing and a bunch of other folks. So both of those are resources for people listening.
Okay.
Well, John, it has been such a pleasure to have you with us today. You're just a fountain of information and history and thought about this movement. And I'm so grateful for all that you've done and are doing to help our movement move forward. And thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. It's been an honor, and I'm very happy to see all that's going on, and you guys are both doing so much important work.